This episode of Data Knots is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Enhance your technology aptitude. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/datanauts and use the code DATANAUTS30. Today, the Datanauts don our fire suits to see if we can brave the flames of DIY OpenStack. From what we hear, it's a tough go, at least in the experience of some. I mean, maybe rolling your own OpenStack wasn't so bad for you, but it was for our guest. I am Ethan Banks. With me is my red carpet co-host, just back from his movie debut alongside Vin Diesel in Fast and Furious 16, Data Centers Never Die. And that is Mr. Chris Wall. You can follow me on Twitter at EC Banks and Chris at Chris Wall. Our guest today is my friend Tony Burke, who was with us recently talking about the fundamentals of cloud-native applications. If you missed that show, Tony, please introduce yourself to these nice Datanauts people.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tony Burke. My day job is I teach networking courses, typically for Cisco. I teach for a Cisco learning partner called Firefly Education. I teach things like Cisco ACI, Nexus 9K, 7K, 5K, 2K, Fiber Channel, as well as OpenStack. And I'm also a certified skydiving instructor.
You just had to add that, didn't you? It has nothing to do with IT, but you stuck it in there anyways.
Yeah, but it does kind of lend to my credentials as an instructor. If I can effectively teach skydiving, I can probably effectively teach you like the ins and outs of lag.
Well, and it sounds like it's also the experience of DIY OpenStack is jumping out of a plane at 13,000 feet and hoping for the best. I mean that lovingly, audience. I mean it lovingly, but we all know sometimes it's not easy.
Well, Tony, maybe you can set this up for us. Why would I even bother starting with OpenStack instead of, I don't know, vSphere or something?
Starting with Amazon Web Services, it's 10 years old now. Companies have really enjoyed the self-service nature of Amazon Web Services. So I remember the first time that I ever used OpenStack, I was on Horizon, which is their web GUI, and I was kind of going around, and I was spinning up virtual machines and so forth, and I thought, man, this is like kind of a version of vSphere. But what I didn't realize at the time, and what I realize now, is that I was consuming OpenStack as a consumer, as a tenant, not as a IT administrator. So you can hand the keys over. It provides an infrastructure like Amazon Web Services or Microsoft Azure. It hands the keys over to tenants so that they can spin up their own resources without negatively affecting others on that same infrastructure. So it provides a multi-tenant environment and a self-service environment. And if you're a developer and you're used to self-service, it's really, really hard to go back. So VMware vSphere itself is not a self-service environment.
No, it's at its core. It's a hypervisor, which OpenStack is not. It leverages a hypervisor, but that's not its core function.
Right. So ESXi is a hypervisor, but vSphere is a whole suite of tools on top of it, like HA and DRS. But typically, if you're a developer or you're a consumer of IT resources, if you want a virtual machine, you have to open up a ticket. Really, what OpenStack does is it enables a private organization, a private cloud, basically allowing you to get rid of that ticketing system. So your developers can deploy things quicker, they can make changes faster. It kind of goes back to the idea of the cloud-native applications and continuous integration and continuous delivery. We need to be able to make these changes very quickly, and we need some sort of infrastructure that allows us to do so in a safe way. So that's what OpenStack provides for enterprises.
I've typically contrasted it that OpenStack is a type of cloud management portal or CMP or whatever the flavor of what we're calling that today is, of which it can use VMware technologies or other technologies to schedule work at the compute layer. But you're right, vSphere in and of itself runs workloads, and you have to add other ecosystem products or ancillary products provided by VMware or others in order to make it more of a self-service thing, like vRealize Automation as an example.
Exactly. And there is a real push for these infrastructure as a service is kind of the generic name for this, the self-service infrastructure where we're abstracting away compute, networking, and storage, providing them through APIs and perhaps a web interface as well. And one of the big uses for these are the new platform as a services that are exploding, the things like Apprenda, Pivotal Cloud Foundry, Heroku, and some of the others that are exploding in the app development world. So all of those technology platform of a service needs some sort of infrastructure to sit upon. And OpenStack is becoming a popular private cloud way to do that, in addition to public cloud, such as Amazon or Azure.
And I guess part of the value proposition of OpenStack here is because it is an open source platform, it is, I'm using huge air quotes here, free, as opposed to maybe VMware, where you'd be investing wheelbarrows full of gold to get that self-service infrastructure, right?
Yeah, the price, and Chris, my guess is you're more familiar with the pricing on this than I am, but my understanding is that the pricing for getting VMware to that self-service private cloud style, and real quick, when we talk about cloud, it used to be kind of a marketing term like software-defined whatever is. NIST came out with a definition of cloud, and the five characteristics of a public or private cloud is that it must be self-service, must have public APIs, is elastic, multi-tenant, and metered. So I need to be able to know how much of that of those resources I'm consuming at any given time. So when we're talking about private cloud or public cloud, that's what we're talking about. So to be able to provide those five characteristics, it gets kind of spendy on the VMware side, is my understanding at least.
Yeah, and I think it's a matter of how are you going to look at the pricing too? Are you going to look at it as a CapEx game where you're going to invest, I guess like Ethan said, was it wheelbarrows of gold or unobtainium or Thor's hammer in exchange for buying vRealize and the suite, you know, such as business and automation and orchestration or various products within that suite? Are you going to spend the CapEx to buy those things and then ultimately leverage the fact that they are a suite and mostly work together with maybe a little professional services sprinkled on top for flavor? Or are you going to go down the OpEx rabbit hole, which may or may not be awesome for you or horrible for you? Meaning, do you have the talent in-house to do such a thing? Are you already kind of proficient in the entire ecosystem around OpenStack, whereas you're not having to pay necessarily for licensing or whatnot? Although, Tony, there's options where you could go with someone kind of in the middle. They have their own flavor of OpenStack, and they're going to sort of help you deploy it. It's not as stark of a reality as do it yourself or buy someone else's product. There's options in the middle.
Yeah, there's OpenStack, you can always go to OpenStack, the website, and download the source code, but almost no one does that. It's kind of like Linux. You can download the Linux kernel and compile your own kernel and create your own distribution on top of that, but almost no one does that. And for the most part, everyone uses a distribution. They pick like Red Hat, or they pick Ubuntu or something like that. And that makes a lot more sense because you're not going to derive much value out of doing it yourself or reinventing a wheel that's already been reinvented like 20 times.
So, Tony, if I make the choice to get started with OpenStack, I've read a lot about OpenStack in a lab environment, and that seems pretty straightforward. Did you spend much time there?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different ways you can sort of kick the tires of OpenStack, play with the APIs, maybe throw a platform as a service added or two. The most popular one that I know about is DevStack. So you can run DevStack, you can run it on a bare metal system, just like a little test system. I've got a little it's a repurposed Dell desktop that I'm running it on. It's pretty easy to set up, and you can even run it inside of a virtual machine. So DevStack, if you spin it up on your ESXi host and you allow nested virtual machines, you can actually run OpenStack inside of a VM. So this is where we cue the Inception soundtrack here. So you can run a VM inside of a VM. Or if you don't have nested virtualization, you can still spin up VMs, but they're a bit slower because they're emulated. DevStack is pretty easy to get going. Most of the OpenStack distributions like Ubuntu or Red Hat have an all-in-one installation. So that's where you install all of the components of OpenStack, the controllers, the compute nodes, the storage part, all on a single server. That actually works out pretty well. It's pretty easy to get going.
What does it use for the hypervisor with DevStack? Does it assume you've already brought one to the table, or does it deploy KVM somewhere for you, or...
It deploys KVM or QMU, so you can use the emulation in QMU, or you can use KVM if you're doing nested virtualization.
Got it.
So if I want to do this at home, now you mentioned, yeah, I can go bare metal, I can do hypervisor on hypervisor with DevStack. Is there a baseline physical requirement of a server? Let's say I had a 486 from about 25 years ago with 4 meg of RAM.
What do you mean, if you had that? I know you have one of those. You have
probably
two of those.
Not enough, huh?
I've got a fort built from old computer carcasses. No, it's anything reasonably decent. You need to have the virtualization extensions, so that it's like VTD or VTX or AMDV. And I think most processors bought in the past like 10 years have that. Or maybe not 10 years, but anything bought in the last 5 years. It doesn't need to be a fancy system. You can use the built-in SATA controllers are usually supported on these devices. Sometimes they get a little persnickety on the network devices, especially a lot of the cheaper desktops have kind of crappy network chipsets. But you can easily remedy that with like a $20 or $30 Intel gigabit NIC you buy off of eBay, which is what I've done. So I've got like a stack of these like inexpensive but decent Intel NICs that I get off of eBay.
I was going to say avoid the Realtek cards because they just never seem to work, and get an Intel Pro that's a gigabit and it's going to be $15 to $20 on Amazon.
Yeah, or eBay or whatever, and they work super well. They work with ESXi as well. So if you're going to do that, like the free version of ESXi, they work great with that. Yeah, Realtek bad, Intel good.
Absolutely.
So yeah, it's an old Dell desktop. I think I got it. It was one of those like Best Buy things. It had like a good amount of memory, some disk in there, and it was like $200 or something. So I'm like, yeah, it was sold. You know, just crappy little host, and it runs DevStack, and I've actually moved over to the all-in-one solution. I just throw in an Intel NIC in there, and I'm good to go.
And how much memory are you running, do you know?
That one's 16 gig. You can plug it away with 8 gig, although I don't like powering anything on that has less than 16 gig because it just seems like a waste of electricity at that point.
I'm guessing the bigger issue is how many VMs you're spinning up in the OpenStack environment, and that's going to be where the majority of the memory requirements come in.
Yeah, it's how many VMs you're going to spin up. And if you're running your own kind of back-end infrastructure, you're playing around with VMs or whatever, typically it's not that big of a deal. But the more RAM, the better, of course.
Yeah, and I've not run the DevStack option, but just the small labs where you're looking at 16-some-odd gig of RAM, really the learning is focused on the components, not necessarily running the workloads. So a lot of my workloads were damn small Linux, the DSL deployment, which is, 100 megabytes of RAM per VM, something super tiny. So you can get away with what would the workflow look like if I deployed this thing without actually running an application on it, per se?
Yeah, and some of the platforms as a service, they spin up a bunch of VMs, but you're not necessarily doing much with them. You're just, how do I install like Cloud Foundry and whatnot, and what does that interaction look like? So yeah, if you're just playing around with it, you can use DevStack, or you can even do that inside of a VM.
You know, Ethan, listening to Tony, I think the real takeaway from the first part of the conversation is get your hands dirty with OpenStack. I'm guilty with this. I looked at it using the VMware integrated OpenStack a couple years ago, got acclimated to Nova, and I've worked with SwiftStack for the kind of Swift part of Object Store, but kick the tires. Don't worry too much about running some beefy workloads. Don't worry about buying an amazing server that has 800 gigs of RAM or something. He's talking about 16 gigs of RAM can get you up and going, and just get your hands dirty. Start learning this stuff because it's really maturing. It's been through years of release cycles, and that's why I'm going to things like OpenStack Summit, because this is really starting to become very interesting and relevant to me. What are you thinking, sir?
The big deal for me was DevStack is the easy takeaway, because if you look at OpenStack and start reading through the initial documentation and the presentations of what it is, you're thinking, oh, I need three machines to make this happen, to get all the different node types and so on. No, it doesn't have to be that complicated for the lab. Use DevStack. It runs in a single box or on a single box. You can get away with as little as 8 gig of RAM, possibly, if you're going to just use it to stand up very small workloads. You don't have to have a lot of memory there for VMs. That'll get you a sense of how OpenStack works, and so on. Doesn't have to be a major investment in hardware if you're a home user wanting to get a handle on this thing. And that's what I need to do. I have no excuse. I need to stand up a DevStack and make it go. This episode of DataNauts is brought to you by IT Pro TV. With IT Pro TV, you gain access to the most important tools needed to prepare you for IT certification. For instance, we've got over 1,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content, and 50 hours are added each week. Courses are streamed live and on-demand worldwide to your Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, 4th-gen Apple TV, or, of course, your PC. Plus, you can learn on the go with your mobile device. Course topics include CompTIA, Advanced Security Practitioner, Ethical Hacking, Virtualization, Cryptography, Metasploit, and more. And the new from March 2016, CCNP Security Courses, Microsoft Server 2016 MCSE, and Microsoft System Center Configuration Manager. With IT Pro TV, you get over 100 step-by-step virtual machine labs and Transcender practice exams. That's $109 value. And you get all of that for one low monthly subscription price. And by the way, if you try it and don't like it, there is a no-hassle cancellation policy. Also, there is corporate or group pricing available, and clients that have taken advantage of that include Harvard, MIT, UCSD, Stanford, and others. So check out itpro.tv/datanauts to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 per year, but we have a special offer. Try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code DATANOTS30 to check out their courses, live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off for the lifetime of your account. That is less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Just visit itpro.tv/datanauts. Use the code DATANOTS30 and try it free for 7 days, plus save 30% off the life of your account.
Now that we've baselined a bit on building OpenStack in your environment, I think DevStack sounds cool. It's definitely a takeaway for me to toy around with that. Let's talk about what we originally opened the show with, and that's the idea that putting together OpenStack is somewhat hard. It's a challenge. And Tony, I'd love to get your take. Let's roll through some of the challenges of, I guess, anybody's experience rolling through OpenStack and why it's hard and what that process looks like.
All right. First, I think it might help to kind of disambiguate here. When we talk about rolling your own OpenStack, rolling your own can be used in two ways with OpenStack. One is I'm creating my own OpenStack distribution, which, of course, almost no one does, because that's like creating your own Linux distribution. It's reinventing the wheel that's already been reinvented a bunch of times anyway. When we're talking about rolling your own OpenStack, we're talking about running, installing, and maintaining your own OpenStack platform. So you're running it inside your data center. You want the self-service, the cloudy features you get with Amazon or Rackspace or Azure. You want to have it in your own data center. So that's what we're talking about here. So there's a lot of different OpenStack distributions to choose from, like Red Hat, Ubuntu, Mirantis. So they all have all got these OpenStack distributions. And OpenStack itself is free. It's free as in freedom, free as in beer, but it's also free as in a puppy. It takes quite a lot of care and feeding of an OpenStack distribution to keep it up and running. And that's kind of where some of the challenges are. First of all, installing OpenStack. So when things go wrong, there's a lot of moving parts. OpenStack, we use it as an umbrella term, but OpenStack kind of embraces that microservices style development in that it's a collection of sort of disaggregated state services like Nova for compute, Cinder and Swift for storage, different types of storage, Neutron for the networking aspect, and each of them have their own backend services. For example, Nova relies on a database, and OpenStack is not prescriptive on what database you use. So if you're running an OpenStack platform, you're also maintaining a database. So your DBA...
I think that's a good point to bring up just as an aside is that I still hear today people saying, oh, I run the OpenStack hypervisor. You know, I think OpenStack gets far too many poor comparisons as if it were a hypervisor of some sort, when it's really a management kind of fabric of different projects.
Right, yeah. It's a collection of services, and some distributions use different amounts of those services. I mean, most of the services are Neutron and Nova and Cinder, but some leave out Swift, for example. You can run a separate Swift stack. There's actually a company called Swift Stack that makes a product that you can install and run your own object storage array.
Is that kind of common to just go through the list of projects and say, oh, I don't need object store. I'll just deploy block storage with compute and network. And it sounds like choose your own adventure. Turn to page 7 if you'd like to deploy Nova, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't imagine running OpenStack without Nova, but you can run OpenStack without Swift. And it's more along the lines of the distributions that pick what they choose to have and what they choose to support versus kind of a menu of services that a customer can choose. So it's kind of like, here's what we've got. There are ways to fill in the blanks if there are things missing or that a customer needs.
Sounds like going to a burger shop. They're all going to have a bun and meat and lettuce and tomato, and you choose if you want bacon or fried egg or something.
Yeah, to some degree. And like I said, kind of going back to the challenges of that is that you're not just installing OpenStack. I guess a good comparison would be with vSphere, for example. You know, how long does it take to install vCenter? That's like a 10-minute install. With OpenStack, it's a much more involved process because you're installing the operating system, the Linux operating system, or in some cases, like Solaris is supported. Oracle's got a OpenStack on Solaris.
Just give me the chills.
Yeah. I actually started out as I think I mentioned in the last podcast, I started out as a condescending Unix administrator. So it didn't give me chills. It gives me like kind of fond memories, but
warm and fuzzies. Got it. Yeah.
Yeah. Warm and fuzzy. But yeah, it's difficult to install and you're also maintaining a lot of different components. There's a lot of moving parts. You've got backend databases for each of the services. So you're a DBA. You've got to make sure that those backend databases are HA, for example. You've got a messaging bus like RabbitMQ that you have to keep and maintain and monitor. So there's a lot of different moving parts.
OpenStack's really popular though, Tony. So, I mean, in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, there's a problem. I get an error message. Something's not working. I pop it into Google. I get some hit back on a forum. Oh, six people have been here before me, and here's how I solve the problem. Off I go. Not the case?
That has not been my experience. So about a year and a half ago, I went to do a multi-node OpenStack installation, and I'm thinking, okay, it's going to be like vSphere. I'm going to spend like half an hour on this or whatever. And I'm a Unix administrator, Linux administrator. I've been in Linux for almost 20 years now. And then I go in and I get these error messages. I follow the instructions and the I'm not going to say which distribution it was because they all kind of have this problem, or at least they did. And you type in the command that it tells you to type in, and you get this error message. And then you're like, okay, well, if you're a good engineer, you're going to take that error message and you're going to take it directly to Google. Because, I mean, admit it, that's what we all do.
I count on it. Yeah, yeah. It's a natural thing you do, of course.
I not only use the brains I've got, but I use the brains, all the brains I can get access to. So you type in the error into Google, and then the kind of terrifying moment as an engineer is you get zero results. So you're like, okay, I'm on my own. So that's there was a lot of that when I was doing installations of OpenStack.
So they have the IRC channel and stuff, right, too.
Yeah, you could potentially use that or mailing lists, but the latency and jitter on that in terms of networking terms we get on that is a bit higher, and sometimes they'll help you, sometimes they won't. And it's
not like you go to Stack Overflow, type in the question, immediately find the top answer is highly rated, copy and paste it, and you're done. This is like, oh my gosh, I hope the tumbleweed tumbling over here is going to possibly help me at some point.
Exactly. And that's a challenge. And again, contrasting to the VMware world, the VMware has been around for a while and been in mainstream use for almost. Yeah, it's been in mainstream use for 6-7 years. So there's a wide pool of talent of people that know the systems in and out. All the error messages have been put into blog articles of people. Hey, I found, I got this error and I figured it out, and here's the answer. Or usually if I have a problem in VMware, it pops up a result on their knowledge base and they figured it out and they post it. There's not that net in OpenStack right now, partly because it's not as widely used as VMware is, and also because it's a moving target. OpenStack is constantly, in Star Trek terms, it's in a state of flux. They're rapidly releasing new features, new way of doing things, which is cool. But it does present a challenge in terms of trying to troubleshoot what comes out.
How do you upgrade this thing? Because the way you're describing it, it's not like this one monolithic thing and then you run setup on the upgrade and off you go, it's been upgraded. You're describing it as a million little pieces that you have a lot of care in feeding. What in the world is the upgrade process like?
Well, it depends on the distribution, but typically it involves upgrading the baseline Linux packages. So whether it's RPM or Debian packages, depending on what package management system that distribution uses. So there's some independencies there. OpenStack releases on a 6-month cadence. So every 6 months they have a new version of OpenStack. Although something to keep in mind, if you're a consumer of OpenStack, you don't really care about whether or not you're on Kilo or on Liberty or any of the other. We use alphabetical naming conventions. So I think Kilo is the most recent release. No, Liberty is the most recent release. But it doesn't really matter. As a consumer of OpenStack, what you care about is the version of the APIs. Like, is it the Nova 2.0 API or the Nova 2.1 API?
As I recall, all of the OpenStack components talk to each other through those APIs.
Correct. Just like a microservices architecture, just like Netflix does. Rather than having components making system calls to each other, they're communicating to each other through APIs. And then you communicate, you consume it, or your platform as a service consumes it, or your applications consume it through those APIs. And what we really care about is the version of those APIs. So that's the most important part. A lot of the distributions are actually several versions behind what the latest version of OpenStack has released, plus some bug fixes, plus some feature sets. Maybe they're running on Kilo, but they've got this new feature in Liberty that they like, so they backport it into Kilo. But for the most part, we don't care about that as consumers of OpenStack. We care about the API version. Regardless, the upgrades is a challenge as well in terms of I've got a new version out or I've got some patches that have come out. Maintaining that can be a challenge.
If I remember correctly, the ability to upgrade is kind of recent to the world of OpenStack. Before, it was just throw it away and do another one.
Yeah, and part of that is the idea of the immutable infrastructure. When our background with like VMware vSphere or even back in the Unix days is that we built up this infrastructure and we have to maintain it, keep it running. Immutable infrastructure, the idea there is that we've got a definition of that infrastructure. We've got the blueprint for the infrastructure. so that we can tear it down and set it back up again. And we just move our workload back onto it. So that was part of it. And part of it was just that they hadn't gotten around to providing the ability to do that. And most of the distributions have an ability to do upgrades now, but it's still a challenge.
Tony, you mentioned high availability a bit ago. What does that look like in the OpenStack world?
OpenStack typically has, you divide out your OpenStack hosts into controller nodes and computer service nodes, or like storage nodes or network nodes. So your controller nodes are especially where you need to keep things HA. You've got a backend database, for example, for Nova. Nova controller relies on a backend database, relies on a backend messaging queue. And you need to make sure those services, you need to monitor those services, you need to have those services running on multiple systems. If you're using MySQL or Postgres as your backend, you need to make sure that that's running in an HA manner. So active standby, standby. If you've got three controller nodes, which is very common. So you have to make sure that all that's running and troubleshooting and so forth. And you've also got log files everywhere. So you've got your MySQL log files. You've got your log files for RabbitMQ or whatever. So you've got to have a way to aggregate all that and keep an eye on all those services.
And when Ethan talks about HA, in this context that you're answering it, you're talking about making sure that the OpenStack components themselves are highly available, not the workloads running on whatever the compute is for OpenStack.
Precisely. The backend services like the Nova service, the Neutron service, they all have backend components, and we need to make sure that not only that those backend components are HA, but the Nova service itself. So we've got an API, you hit it at a URL. We need to make sure that URL is going to not go away if we lose a host.
Is there guidance on deploying these applications in an HA fashion, or is it just, hey, you need a database, here's the 13 ones you can pick from, good luck, and then, you know, it's sort of up to you?
Yeah, so OpenStack is not very prescriptive when it comes to that. The distributions get pickier. The distributions will pick a backend database typically, or they might whittle down the backend databases that you can use to a far fewer number. And I kind of wish OpenStack would be more prescriptive about the backend database. Whether or not you're a big fan of MySQL or a big fan of Postgres, you're not interacting with it directly. It's part of a backend service. My take is, who cares? I don't care what the backend database is. What I care about is having that service, that Nova service or whatever. Or I don't even care about that. I just want to have an infrastructure that I can rely on. I kind of wish it was more prescriptive.
I guess that's just a side effect of it being an open project contributed by dozens of different organizations or hundreds of contributors, is that it's hard to make a hard line on any particular technology choice because everyone has a varying opinion. And there's always strengths and minuses to every type of technology. It's hard to say this is the one they're going to go with because that's a political nightmare.
Yeah, I think that's the problem that they've run into. And it's not to say that open source in general is not a good choice. I'm certainly a huge believer in open source. And we're seeing industry-wide a huge move to open source in just about every, you know, networking. We're seeing more open source tools. Cisco's got a bunch of stuff on GitHub. We've had open source hypervisors for a long time. And so everything is moving more towards open source. And I think that's a great thing. But there are new challenges with that.
You know, Chris, as I was listening to Tony, one of the things that bummed me out a little bit was just how bleeding edge OpenStack is in a certain sense. Because, yes, it's been out there for some years and there's been a lot of iterations of the code. But, man, it's still kind of the wild, wild west in a sense. I am very used to, I've got this problem trying to install thus and so, or I've got this error message, feed it into Google and immediately get a whole bunch of results of people that have talked about the problem. And it doesn't sound like that's the case with OpenStack, meaning, oh gosh, I'm going to have to engage with another human to possibly find the answer to the problem, which, sometimes I just don't want to do that, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, and it feels like also maybe some of this is the secret sauce, right? Getting this up and running is what differentiates one company to the next, and maybe they don't want to share that. But my personal thought, having heard the conversation around troubleshooting, is that there's also a lot of different ways you can build OpenStack, depending on what you pick as far as roll your own, which it sounds like not a lot of people do, but the various deployments that you choose. It's not like VMware where it's, you know, okay, it's the Windows server. Start here, finish here. If throughout the workflow there's some issue, here's how you fix it. No, this is more choose your own adventure as far as what you're going to use for the database and the message queue. And everyone's adventure is going to differ in some minor ways. And when you add up all those minor differences, it becomes a unique challenge. So it isn't necessarily Googleable at that kind of very binary level. You have to sort of figure out what you're going to do or try to mirror someone else's deployment in order to really make it an easy method for troubleshooting.
Tony, you gave us a lot of kind of disheartening reality about what it's like to run your own OpenStack, which I guess is a perfect segue into the fact that there's a bunch of canned OpenStack packages out there. Mirantis comes to mind, for example. Does it make more sense to go that direction, talk to Mirantis and say, please help me with a lot of handholding to make OpenStack go?
I think first I want to kind of, you know, we did speak a little bit about doom and gloom on OpenStack and some of the challenges that you face, but that's not to say that those are insurmountable challenges. There are organizations that are running their own OpenStack. They're using the distributions and they're running their own OpenStack infrastructure and they're being very successful with it. I think some of the biggest examples are Walmart. So Walmart.com's entire front end is powered on top of OpenStack, or PayPal. PayPal runs on top of OpenStack. So companies are being successful with OpenStack, but I think if you're going to do that, and it may make sense for some organizations, and it absolutely does make sense for some organizations, you need to have a pretty beefy staff to handle that. So it's not going to be like someone part-time, you know, they've got their time divided between a couple different projects, including maintaining OpenStack. That's not going to work operationally, at least not with OpenStack as it exists today. So for those organizations that can't hire a dedicated OpenStack team, or just it doesn't make any sense to hire a dedicated OpenStack team, there's another way to consume OpenStack. Cisco Metapod, Platform 9, Mirantis has a private OpenStack offering. All of these basically are different variations on a kind of a third way to consume OpenStack. So the first way is to roll your own OpenStack distribution, which almost no one does. Second way is to use one of the OpenStack distributions provided by like Ubuntu or Red Hat, which some customers will do and some enterprises do and some enterprises are very successful with. But for the organization that can't pull off either of those two, there's a third option that's shaping up and becoming very popular. And that's where someone runs an OpenStack infrastructure for you. So for example, I teach primarily Cisco courses. I don't work for Cisco. And I'm not here to advocate a Cisco product. I'm more here to advocate kind of this third way here. But I'll use Cisco as an example because I'm most familiar with it, Cisco Metapod. With Cisco Metapod, you pay Cisco to run OpenStack in your data center or in your colocation facility. So they'll go in and they'll do the installations of OpenStack on components. They'll go in and monitor OpenStack. They'll go in and do the upgrades and so forth. So they will provide you the APIs. They'll provide you with the Horizon graphical interface. They'll run the components. They'll maintain the underlying Linux infrastructure. They'll make sure that the MySQL or whatever is HA, and they'll keep everything, those APIs HA, they'll keep them available to you.
I mean, the trade-off being here is a pretty obvious one. Instead of OpenStack, again, huge air quotes, free, not that any such thing is in actuality free, but you're now paying money to Cisco for services and expertise and bringing the system up for you and et cetera.
Yeah, and of course, it's not just Cisco. There's also Platform 9, and Mirantis has an offering like this, I believe, and Blue Box.
Isn't that basically public cloud, but just in a private environment? Like you're paying for someone to run infrastructure that you consume?
Yeah, it is. And it's more of a combination of OpEx and CapEx. So on a public cloud, you're using someone else's data center and you're paying per month, which is great in some cases, especially if you're a startup and you don't have to have the capital outlay. Or, for example, Netflix, they are famous for they will not do their own data centers, even if it might save them money down the road, because if they get any bit of capital, they want to spend it on creating a new season of Daredevil or a new season of Orange is the New Black rather than buy a bunch of switches and servers and so forth. So if you need to make sure that your expenditures are OpEx, then like an Amazon's a great platform for that. But for consistent workloads, sometimes it's cheaper to run it in-house. So you buy your own equipment. You spend the money on the servers and the switches and whatever physical infrastructure, disks and so forth. And you run it and you own it. In all these cases, you own the hardware.
Mm. You own the data plane, but you've outsourced the control plane in essence.
Yeah. So you own the hardware and the management, you're outsourcing to someone else. And that's where the hard part is. So you get this cost savings that you can amortize over time of a capital expenditure, but you also get the benefit of someone maintaining that infrastructure for you. And it's not free. Of course, these companies are charging money for it. So you're paying either on a per host or a per socket basis rather than paying for per VM or per byte transferred. So you get the cost benefit of that CapEx versus being charged for every little bit you consume.
Yeah, that sounds sane, thinking about back when I was in the customer side, the dilemma of, do I want to build a data center? Do I want to colo? And obviously, if you colo, there's certain costs associated with them managing and making sure that everything's monitored and whatnot. But I don't have to be an expert in HVAC and cooling systems and what the wiring and electrical looks like. I can just throw my gear in this environment and use it. This feels kind of like the cloud version of that. I just want to use my gear, maybe in my own data center, maybe in a colo, doesn't really matter. But I want someone else to do the stuff that I don't really care too much about and probably don't have a lot of expertise in, which is running the control plane. I just want to consume it while at the same time getting the advantages on the CapEx side of depreciating my physical assets, because maybe I'm going to run them at 100% all the time and I don't want to pay the, you know, the cloud fees associated with that.
Yeah, like, and if you've got one virtual machine and you buy a Nexus 7000 switch, you know, that's a very expensive Nexus 7000 switch. But if you put 400,000 virtual machines or 40,000 virtual machines and it's all running on top of a pair of Nexus switches, then those Nexus switches become a lot cheaper. You get the cost benefit of putting more into more applications, more of your workload into a given infrastructure. So
that brings a good point, thinking, what if I start small and I'm using some kind of public infrastructure? Can I eventually, I'm getting so big and I'm paying all this money per month to live in Amazon or whatever. Can I then start standing this up and migrate over? Are the APIs compatible enough, or is that still a pretty heavy lifting migration effort to leave public cloud and enter a sort of private OpenStack cloud?
OpenStack in particular was built to be a lot like Amazon. So the APIs are either identical or very similar. So it doesn't take much to do that. And a lot of these new platforms that are coming out, like, you know, Prendas and the Cloud Foundries, have hooks into both. So it's pretty easy to migrate that in terms of that workload. What companies tend to use these private clouds for is consistent workloads. And they tend to use them for workloads where there's data sovereignty concerns. Like, I don't trust my, you know, I'm a bank or I'm a healthcare provider, and I'm not sure about putting all my stuff on Amazon or Azure. Or a lot of, you know, especially countries in Europe, they have border data sovereignty issues. If you're in Luxembourg, you know, am I going to use a data center in Germany? That kind of thing. So
it's a nice choice.
Yeah, to be able to move that, get the flexibility of that cloud experience, of that self-service, and then, but still having it in your own data center. And if you have a consistent workload over time, a lot of times it ends up being cheaper to pay the money to buy the servers, the switches, the disks, rather than to continually pay Amazon the same amount of money over and over and over again. So there's cost savings there too. You don't have to pick one. The term hybrid cloud has been used a lot, and that's, I've got some of my workload is very bursty. Maybe you've got like a Black Friday sale, or I've got some events that only happen a few times a year and I need to spin up 1,000 new virtual machines. I'm not going to build out the infrastructure to do that if I'm just going to use it 4 or 5 times a year. So I put it up on Amazon. It's great for that. Or maybe I've got a consistent workload. I'm running Hadoop or I'm running something. I need a composable infrastructure to run that on top of. Maybe I'm only doing Hadoop at night when most of my other services aren't running. Then I can run it in-house and I get the cost benefits of that CapEx there.
Tony, is there anybody doing what I'll describe as an enhanced distribution, where it's a distro of OpenStack, but it's got a lot of pretty wrappers and wizards put into it to make it easier to get the install done?
Yeah. In fact, all of the OpenStack distributions have those. It is a work in progress and they're getting better. So I believe and I hope that OpenStack will be easier to consume in the future. And they're making strides in this. For example, there's the open source Fuel project, which is meant to be an OpenStack orchestrator in terms of the actual getting OpenStack up and running, standing it up. Red Hat's got Director to do the same thing. So they're making improvements in these technologies. But right now, if you're an organization who's got a couple of folks that are dealing with virtualization, for example, maybe that person is dealing with a couple different technologies, it's probably not a good fit to throw OpenStack at them, because it takes a while to ramp up on OpenStack and it kind of requires a more dedicated team. Another thing is when we talk about the cost, most of these services end up being cheaper than VMware if you're going to get VMware up to the self-service, you know, vRealize automation, vRealize orchestration. So that even though you are paying the money, you're paying Cisco or you're paying Platform 9, even though you're paying the money to run OpenStack for you, it still ends up being cheaper a lot of times than the licensing cost of VMware. Although, of course, you know, your mileage may vary.
Well, Mr. Wall, I think that's the show. What do you say?
I'll tell you what I don't say. I don't say the word dumpster fire. That's not a word that I use. No,
not a word.
But yeah, never going to say that. But yeah, absolutely. I feel like my stack is quite open and strong now. So I'm looking forward to dev stacking in the near future.
Yes, that is, I think my takeaway is I need to start there with DevStack. Get it stood up. I've got servers and I've got space. Let's make this thing happen.
And how many people today are going to the OpenStack Summit? I'm raising my hand virtually. I'll be there. Tony, you going to be at the OpenStack Summit in Austin?
Not this one. I've been to... When we had it in Oregon and in Portland here, I went to it, but and that was a couple of years ago. But I'm not going to this one in Austin.
Me either, buddy. Sorry, not going to make it. I mean, it's your backyard, but I'm not going to.
Yeah, make it's kind of cheating when it's a 1 mile walk to get there. But hey, listeners, if you're going to be at the OpenStack Summit, I will be there. Come say hello. If you've got show ideas, etc., hit me up. And I'm a total noob when it comes to OpenStack, so you can teach me cool things. Put me under your wing. I don't eat very much, and I work for free. So let's do it.
Tony, are there any resources you'd recommend online for folks that want to dig in more? And while you're at it, tell us how we can follow you on the internet.
Resources, certainly play with DevStack. If you want to find the all-in-one solutions, just Google OpenStack all-in-one. And usually there's some free, either like Red Hat, OpenStack Platform's got a free trial you can do for 60 days and play with their OpenStack distribution. Ubuntu, I think, has a free version of their OpenStack all-in-one. So you can certainly play with that. Play with both the underlying infrastructure and play with the API. So standing up virtual machines and playing with things like Heat, which is a orchestration declarative thing that you have in OpenStack. You can find me online at Twitter at tburke. That's at tburke. And then also at datacenteroverlords.com is where I blog. And more lately, I've been doing screencasts. Like I just did an explanation that LACP is not lag, is not link aggregation. So
yeah, I'll give you a verbal plus one. If you want to check out Tony's screencast, I highly advise it. It's very educational and filled with little funny tidbits. So it's good stuff.
One thing that OpenStack has I've found very useful in my own data center is that immediate spin up of a virtual machine. So if I want to play with something, rather than take the time to install a new VM in VMware, OpenStack uses immutable images in order to create an instance or a virtual machine. So it's very, very quick to do that. So I save a lot of time by going to my OpenStack server, then going to my ESXi server in order to like spin something up, play with it, a new technology or whatever, and then I can destroy it when I'm done. That's something that I found one of those all-in-one OpenStack solutions that have been great for in my own data center. So I actually have an ESXi host for some of the stuff that I do, and I have an OpenStack server for some of the stuff I do. Neither, of course, are HA, but just for my own home lab playing around, it's great for that.
And that concludes today's DataNauts podcast. You can reach me, that's Ethan Banks, at ecbanks on Twitter, and my blog is ethancbanks.com. And Chris is at Chris Wall on Twitter, and his blog is wallnetwork.com. And for more timely and technical DataNauts podcasts, direct your browser to packetpushers.net. There, you will find every DataNauts podcast we've ever recorded. We discuss things like cloud, containers, storage, certifications, home labs, anything to do with infrastructure engineering. That's what DataNauts is all about. And if you like this content, give us a review in iTunes or a shout out on Twitter. We do appreciate the love. And until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly made.
Hopefully my cat does not sing you the song of her people, but...
Meow, meow, meow.
You okay, Ethan? You crying back there? Show me on the doll where OpenStack touched you.